So it's a great pleasure to talk to you, Vittorio. May I call you Vittorio?
Please.
When and where were you born?
I was born in Genova, in Italy, in 1923.
Right. And tell me, some people like to go back to their grandparents or even great-grandparents. Tell me something about your
There
antecedents.
is nothing, I think, much remarkable to tell about them. I mean, they were very modest people, culturally modest. They all belonged to the Jewish tribe from Piedmont, which is a fairly small tribe. It's only a couple of thousand people now, perhaps 5,000, but less than that. And there are some of them have been extraordinarily distinguished. There are three Nobel Prizes among those, for example. But in my family, there is nothing particularly remarkable to tell. But there is one small exception, which is maybe amusing. My grandfather was born in a ghetto because he was born in 1860 or 65 in the Pope States. And in the Pope State, the Jewish were not allowed to live elsewhere. But so he emancipated only when he was a child in 1870, when Rome was taken over by Piedmont, in the beginning of the Italian state. And he then went to school, and one day, I was told, a schoolmaster, school teacher, I should say, made the comment that to my grandfather's ears sounded anti-Semitic. And he took the ink bottle and threw it to his face. And as a consequence of that, he was expelled from the whole educational system in Italy, and he had to emigrate to Argentina. And it's an anecdotic fact which has profound consequences on my life. That's why I mentioned that. And on the other side, my mother's grandmother, on the maternal side, this grandfather's wife, of course, belonged to a fairly distinguished Jewish family also in Piedmont, cultivated. I mean, she studied as a schoolmaster. Now, for a Jewish girl in 1880 to be a schoolmaster, what a very high degree, I think, even in this country. Okay. And then the family's prosperity was based upon silk. And there was a famous disease in the silkworm. You probably heard of that by 1885 or something like that. And it meant to the ruin of the family. I mean, bankruptcy and so on. And they also emigrated to Argentina. And that was my American side of the family, which has, as I'll tell you, a profound influence on my future, my fate. Because in 1938, when the anti-Semitic policy started in Italy, the first thing my father did was to decide that the whole family would move to Argentina, of course, since my mother was born there. And that's why I'm saying, I mean, it's a very important fact which makes all the difference from me and Primo Levi, for example.
Yes. Well, you mentioned Primo Levi, and I gather he was some relative of yours?
Yes. Well, I like and dislike to talk about Primo Levi. I was a close friend of him. I loved him very much. But he became such a famous character, then I have the feeling that I'm using his flag. You know? But I'm going to say a few facts.
Just a few facts.
Yes. His mother and my father were first cousins, exactly the same age, two big families, and they grew up together. And they have been very close to each other until the very end of their life. And I knew him when I was a child. And I used to go to Torino, where my family had its roots in Torino, not in Genoa, for a few weeks just before schools open in September, usually. And I would go and play with him. And he was 2 or 3 years older than I, And at that age, it meant a lot. Mm. It was a age he knew a lot of the information and games and so on. And he was an extremely sweet person, extremely kind. So that's what I remember of him. Then we moved to Argentina, and he stayed in Italy. And you know the rest of the story. I met him again when I returned to Europe in 1947. And we kept fairly close. We tried to meet once, twice, three times a year, if we could. Mm. And I would say we had been fairly close friends. That's it. But I didn't have any important conversation to report with Primo Levi that I remember. Mm. Okay?
Yes. I mean, you may want to move on, but I'm a great, like many people, I'm a great admirer of Primo Levi, and yeah. I have read most of his books. And you said he was a sweet, kind person when he was a little boy. Was he the same in 1947 when you, after that
experience? Oh, yes. I mean, sweet, he would listen to people a lot. He was prepared to ask questions and wait for your reaction. And he was always benevolent. He was very kind. Mm. Okay, but unusually kind. Mm. Because believe me, when you are 10, to spend your time playing with a boy of 7 is no fun. Right? You have been a child, is that?
I have been a child.
As I have.
Yes.
And I was not that patient.
This is just the usual question, but there is no need for you to answer, but I feel I must ask. I mean, having read his wonderful books and seen how he seemed to handle his despair and awful experience through his writing and so on, it was obviously a great shock to all of us that he committed suicide. Was it as much a shock to you? I mean,
well, I know nothing about that, and I know that he had psychological problems before that. Mm. He had a depression and so on. Mm. So in my opinion, the roots of what happened have to look into that. But I know nothing, and I know that a lot of nonsense has been said on that. Mm. It's kind of gossip, right?
Yes.
Which I dislike.
And the last question on him is that he unusually combined being a very good scientist and some of his scientific writing, like the periodic table and so on, is very good, but also being a very good autobiographer and novelist. Did you ever talk to him about writing or see him writing?
Yes. Well, not about his writing, but about my potential writing. Right? I mean, he made some very amusing suggestions to me. I mean, I went through a very, well, let's say, dramatic period in my life. I mean, my first wife committed suicide. And he was very close to her. Because Primo and his wife had come to Paris and stayed with us for 10 days or a couple of weeks immediately after the marriage. It was the first trip to Paris. And so we shared the small flat with them, and we kept very close to each other. And at that time, I was really upset. I mean, you know, when you were shaken up and you're looking where to set foot. And I was thinking of writing, what I did only recently, in fact. And the problem was, as you may guess, as an anthropologist, the language. Because my mother language had been the Italian throughout my life. But I went to university in Argentina in Spanish, and then all my professional life took place in France, with the exception of 1 year in the United States and very frequent visits to Cambridge. So the point, when I take a pen or a word processor to write something, is in which language I'm going to write it. And he had a very amusing idea. He said, why don't you write in many languages? He said, go on.
A very good idea, right? Depending on the kind of writing and the mood, you write in a different language.
Yeah, but the point was, then you'll see. Mm. You'll read again. Mm. But don't worry about the language. That was his point.
Very, very sound
advice. And I thought it in amusing.
Mm, yes, indeed. Well, let's come back to you. Were any of your grandparents influential on you?
Not. Well, yes and no. Not intellectually. My grandmother lived with us, very near to us, not in our flat. And she moved back to Argentina with us when we went to Argentina. And she was a very energetic woman. So we were all scared of her. But I loved her, but in that sense, but not elsewhere. And my father's father was a very sweet man, but he had very little influence on me. My father had a very strong influence.
And tell me about your father.
Well, my father is one of those people whose life was cut by the First World War. I mean, he was drafted when he was 19, and he left the army when he was 24. And the family was fairly poor. Well, not very poor, but not wealthy. And so he could not go to university. And he would have gone. He would have liked to go to university. And he was a highly cultivated man, but especially he had very strong and firm political opinions, my father. He was very strongly against fascists. And he said it openly. Other people, I know of other people whose father, people of my age, whose father was probably as anti-fascist as my father, but their father didn't want to display that because their opinion was that it's not good for children to have in the house an education. My father was the opposite. Okay? And, I mean, my first reading comes from my father's. I mean, when I was 12 or 13, he put in my hands the great Russians, Tolstoy, Chekhov, and so on, or Italo Svevo, you know that writer. Italo Svevo.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I'm sure. La coscienza di Zen. Yes, which in those days were not common reading, especially what was abominable in the fascist days in Italy, was rhetorics. I mean, just words, d'annunzio. You know, in that respect, he had a very strong influence, my father, on me.
What was his occupation? What did he do?
Well, he was a businessman.
Successful? Was he quite a successful businessman?
No, not in the British sense. No, he made his living. In fact, he had very close connections with Britain. Because he had a scholarship, I think, when he left the army. And he spent 6 months, I think, somewhere in Liverpool, I think, of all places. And then he worked with England. I mean, he had work connections with Britain, and he used to come here, I say, once every second year or something. And when he came back, for a few days, we would have breakfast, sitting around the table. Because, you know, in Italy, breakfast is not a meal. You just drink a cup of coffee and leave the house. And he forced all of us to have what he called British breakfast.
What about your mother? Tell me.
My mother was a good pianist. That's the main point about her.
Good
she
pianist.
Was my mother, of course, but she was a good pianist. And, well, music, thanks to her, plays a great role in my education. She had to make a choice at the age of 22, 23 when she got married, either my father or to be trained as a professional pianist. She had to go to Paris with Wanda Landowska. And her choice was to get married and have children. But she played always, she played local concerts. But she had a strong taste in music, in Baroque music, and she used to analyze that music in a complicated way, and that is something I acquired with her, that music is not just something pleasant, but you work in your mind. I mean, it's something worth analyzing.
Tell me more about the role of music in your life. I mean, what music do you like? Does it
Baroque music.
Baroque music.
And, you know, this is really a matter of education. Mm-hmm. It really matter of education. I often worry when I see people enjoying other kind of music and me not enjoying. Mm-hmm. And I rather envy them. Okay, if you someone enjoys a drink that mm-hmm. you dislike, he's a heavy one. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really a matter of education. It's indubitable in me.
And within the Baroque, who are your favorite?
Well, the piano music, of course, mm-hmm. Mozart is the center, right? Mm-hmm. But Mahler would play not beyond Beethoven, mm-hmm. or Schubert, mm-hmm. or Beethoven, not beyond. And backwards, well, 17th century.
Mm-hmm. Right. Does it, I mean, relating to your work, some people find listening to music inspirational when they're working, or others find it as a relaxation to stop from thinking too much, or
it happens to me like to everybody, but I don't like it very much. Mm. I like to listen to music,
mm. yeah.
not to have this bruit de fond.
Yeah. So let's now go to your childhood. What's your first memory, apart from sort of the sun shining? I think that is a concrete memory.
Well, that's an amusing question, because my father's mother, my grandmother, died when I was 2.5, I think, or something like that. Or I keep a vivid memory of a scene with her. But probably I was told that story. So I'm not quite sure about that.
What was the memory?
No, that I wake up in a big bed and there's plenty of gifts on a table next to the bed. Mm. That is what I call a precise memory. Mm. But I'm a bit skeptical about it.
Christmas, probably. Or your birthday. What was your? Where was your first school?
In Genoa, always. Mm. The public school in the continental sense. Mm. I don't know how we call it. It's not the public school in Britain, right? Mm. It was elementary school and gymnasium.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
What age did you go to that school?
Ordinary age. I was born in August, so there never was any problem. I started with the other children. Mm.
When you were about 5?
No, in Italy it was 6 at that time. Mm.
Do you remember anything about that school? Do you remember anything?
No, I remember quite well all the schools I went to. Mm. I remember I remember the teachers.
Mm. Well, pick out one or two teachers who, if there were any that particularly you.
As a consequence of my father's strong opinion that he was telling us all the time, I mean, he was against the Mussolini and so on. So, whenever someone could be called anti-fascist, quotation mark, right? I mean, you don't have to think of any extremist or politically active people, but people who would be prepared to chat with my father and show that they were not fascists, but by and large, it was very mild. So all these people acquired some importance to my art. And for example, I have not a school, it was a high school, I don't know the terminology in this country, gymnasium, right?
Gymnasium.
11 to 13,
yep.
Right? That age. Well, the Italian system was, I don't know what it is here, whether it's the same there, that there was one principal teacher who had us in his hands for 4/5 of the time. He'd teach Italian, Latin, history, geography, and Greek, when Greek came into that, right? So we only had gymnastics and foreign language. There were different. And one of those had a profound influence on me because he shared many of my father's opinions. And this had important consequences on the educational way, because One of the trouble in the fascist day is that rhetoric, inflation, was fashionable. And this man was quite the opposite. He would teach us understatement. Okay, he would avoid, whenever possible, to have to comment on Mussolini's achievements or things like that, which were very common in those days in Italian school. Some were compulsory, right, for the professors. Something else, you know that all the children in Italian schools were members of the fascist party. This was compulsory. It's like Hitlerjugend. Mm-hmm. And so one of the good things to do was to have weapons, arms, and the teacher teaching you how to unload, shoot, not shoot, you wouldn't shoot in the classroom. Okay, and my professor hated it. Like my father, I mean, they were the same age, and they went through the war the same way. They were officers during the war, and they hated the war. My father hated. And he hated weapons, for example. He never allowed us to play with, very common to children, right? To boom, boom, boom. And that's something my father never allowed us to do. So this man, Professor Pinno, what's his name? I'm very pleased to pronounce it. Left a profound trace on my education, in my memory of my education, because you never know. And quite the opposite. I have some other very ordinary professor, technically probably just as competent, but no, I didn't like them, and even now they did. But there is something else which may amuse you. That this was at the very first beginning, probably in first or second year or elementary school. I was six or seven. And I had a teacher, was a lady, a woman, and she was very thin, very old. She may have been 35, right? But in my memory she was very old, and she was the sister, the parish sister of the local church. And so she was dressed with a black gown, and she was behaving very humbly always. And one day one of my schoolmates made openly a despising comment about the Jews. Something ridiculous, right? Which might have said against a Neapolitan, just the same way. She stopped the class, and for 1 hour, she explained that these things should never happen. Which is amusing, because people don't, by the way, in Italian schools, you hardly had more than one child in a class, on the average. But very rare, as you know. I mean, in a city like Genoa.
What kind of child?
One child. One Jewish child.
Oh, Jewish child, yes.
I mean, the population, I mean, I think that the Jewish population in Genoa were a few hundred, not a thousand people, out of a million, or close to a million. So it was a very rare bird. And so you ask me questions, I'm answering.
Well, I mean, since you've raised it several times, many of the distinguished scientists and others I've interviewed have been Jewish, and I quite often ask them whether to reflect on whether they think this has influenced their academic life. Some of them, for instance, Simon Schaffer, who is a historian and philosopher of science, said that being Jewish in England, as he was, made him feel both inside the society very comfortable, but also always on the edges, always the outsider, watching himself and other people, a double identity in a sense. And others have said something vaguely similar to that. Is there any way you've reflected on how being Jewish, because if everyone was Jewish, as some of my American interviewees are in America, in New York or something, they say, well, it had no effect because everyone, all my friends were Jewish and everyone I met was Jewish. But if you're in a minority, it might be different.
Well, you should first remember my age. Like, I'm 86. Mm-hmm. So, in my young days, emancipation of the Jews, the ghetto, in other words, was not very far. Mm-hmm. Okay, my grandparents had all been born in ghettos. Mm-hmm. So that's something you must keep in mind. Mm-hmm. Then, you should not forget Hitler and the Nazis, unfortunately. And that had a great effect on us. I mean, my wife, she's my second wife, were both Jewish, but none of my children, wife or husband, are Jewish anymore. I mean, these things, probably it would have disappeared with me, with my wife, with my father. I mean, my father's wife, my grandmother, were Jewish also, and my father was, but my father was trying to get away. Now, being a small minority, as was in Italy, you know that it's less than 1 in 1,000. You know that.
I didn't know that.
No, it's extremely small. Mm. It's quite different from being an Ashkenazi born in the Shettle. You see, I mean, the question you may ask, and I keep wondering, that what happened to those people? Why did they remain Jew? You know that many distinguished Italians were Jewish by, Da Ponte, the Mozart librettist, you know, were Jewish, was born as a Jew. You probably don't know that. Okay, but many others. And in that, there was a very strong pressure of assimilation in Italy, because the Jew didn't look like Jews, as in Poland, for example. They didn't speak any other language but Italian. The only difference was a religion. Now, there was a big pressure on the side of the Catholic Church to convert the Jews and to move them away of the ghetto. There is in Venice ghetto, there is a stone, a very interesting stone to my eyes, it's 17th century, and is signed by the bishop, of archbishop, which reminds the Jews who have converted that they are not allowed to get into the ghetto again. So what happened? It happened that a part of the population, and the stubborn part of the population, remained Jews for reasons of their own. Right? And others just melted into it, and in one generation they would disappear, all the Jewish element. Now, if you select even rabbits on the basis of stubbornness, you get peculiar people. So it's something which, in Italy at least, should be kept in mind. I mean, in my days, perhaps 20 or 30% of the university professors were Jewish in Italy. Now it's much less. But you see, instead of 1/1,000th of the population. So it's not that surprising after all. And this happened to other people as well. I mean, the Armenians, for example, behave that way. Or the Genovese, when they go abroad.
Well, I mean, that very high proportion of professors, as you mentioned, I mean, people like Aaron Klug and... Yep. And
But I was talking about the Italian
university. But in Cambridge, very high proportion of the successful scientists are Jewish. I just interviewed Eric Hobsbawm, for example, the historian, and he's talking about this. This answers the question. I mean, there was no religious side to your upbringing. In other words, you weren't bar mitzvahed or went to celebrated the Jewish festivals or anything. No.
My father's mother, my grandmother, was slightly fanatical. She was extremely religious, and she was a strong woman. I hardly met her. I didn't meet her. And my father resented very much. He didn't like me. He tried to forget. But of course, he's mixed with family connections, especially for the Jews. I mean, he had an uncle, he laughed very much, and this uncle would have Seder, you know, the Jewish, what's the name in English?
Yeah.
So we would go there, because it's mixed up. Mm. It's not only religion, but it's family celebrations as well. And then, of course, Hitler came, and that made the whole thing different.
Mm. What I mean, have you ever followed any other religion, or
no.
are you religious, or
no?
Are you anti-religious? Are you
no? Quite the opposite, I must say.
Mm. You're sympathetic, but not a believer.
I don't believe in the church.
Mm.
No, I'm
not. You don't. I don't know if you know, but there have been a number of English scientists, like Richard Dawkins, who have argued that science disproves religion, and that we should try and destroy religion because it's all irrational and unacceptable and causes a lot of trouble. So there are some scientists who feel, after Darwin, you know, it's intolerable to be religious. You don't feel
I don't have any feeling in society. We are not that rational after all. I mean, sometimes to keep a part of faith in your life, I think it's very important. And I remember Francis Crick. I was told, because I didn't listen to it. I was a fairly good friend of him, that he was interviewed by the BBC. And someone asked him, do you believe in religion? And he said, oh my God, no. I was told that story.
Just to finish with the school period, were there any activities you did as a child or in a little later which you were really passionate about? I mean,
Yes. Mountaineering. Climbing mountains. My father loved it. Mm. He took us along, and throughout my life, I mean, some 15 years ago, I had to stop. Mm. But otherwise, it has been kind of passion, I would say.
Mm. And that often relates to being outdoors and walking and natural history and things like that. Did you collect?
No.
Or watch birds or nothing?
Not really. No. Just I think is physical effort and the beauty, of course.
Mm. Did you play games? Were you a good games player?
Games,
sports?
No, not really. No. Well, I used to swim when I was a boy, but I never was an athletic kind of person. No.
Mm. And did you play, when we talked about music, I didn't ask you whether you played an instrument.
No. In fact, I think it was my mother's influence. She knew that in order to enjoy music, you have to put an enormous effort into it. And since she gave piano lessons, she knew from first-hand experience that most of the time it's wasted.
Mm.
And so she did not really make a great effort. I mean, I was going to play violin. On one occasion, I began taking violin. Then I had a very serious disease which kept me out for 6 months. And at the end of that story, violin was gone.
What, you must have been, what, about 16 when you went to Argentina?
15.
15.
Yeah.
So the end of your schooling was in Argentina?
Yes.
And then you went on to university, or?
Yes, I got a university degree in Argentina.
Mm. In what subject?
Mechanical engineer.
Oh.
Well, there was not much choice,
mm.
I must say. I mean, there was a kind of physics in a loose way, but it was not organized.
Mm. Were there any people, either your contemporaries or teachers, who inspired you or at that stage?
Yes. I mean, there was an Italian, it was Livialdi, not known, who I started working with him in laboratory. And then, you know, Argentina, well, it's a very interesting country. You know, you had a Nobel Prize winner here born in Argentina, you know that.
Mm.
And so in those days, it was my contemporary. They were very bright.
Who was this? No, it doesn't matter.
Memory in my... no, but it will come.
He's a scientist.
Okay. Yes. A colleague of Alan Clark.
Ah, right.
MRC. Yeah. Laboratory Molecular Biology.
Mm.
Yes.
Perutz? Not Perutz.
No. Perutz was from Vienna.
Okay. Well, We'll come back to him, but
yeah.
You must have switched from mechanical engineering into life sciences at some point.
If you want, I lived America in the wrong way, in the sense that I went there, I belonged to an Italian family, and the feeling in the family was that culturally we were superior, that those people were indigenous people, okay? You see what I mean? They did not deserve much attention. And that was not only wrong, but totally stupid, because you probably realize that Buenos Aires is a city which created one of the interesting cultures of our days, much more than Paris, by the way.
I hope your Parisian friends are watching this.
Well, okay. I mean, it's something extremely original that came out of Argentina. And among those people, many are scientists, are very bright. One of those I just tried to mention. Yeah. But I mean, I'm coming from Oxford with Altman. Simon Altman is, again, in Argentina. Many in this country, but many throughout the world. And only too late I realized that I should have learned more in Argentina. I should have made better friends in trying to take roots. But what happened is that we didn't see any possible future in Argentina if you wanted to do science. And in an ordinary way, we were right. The future of scientists in Argentina has been very bad for a very long time. Even now it's not very good. So I wanted to learn something, and then I wanted to go back to Europe. That was the main point. And my fiancée in those days, she was French, and she was a medical student, and she loved the idea to go back to France. And indeed, we left in 1947, we got married, and we settled in France. She became a medical doctor and scientist also. So there was an attraction of Europe, which was very, very strong, which prevented us, to some extent, to really appreciate the best of Argentina. We were far from negligible, far from negligible, in spite of all the difficulties. But countries are interesting very often when they are difficult, not when they become too easy. I don't know if you agree.
Yes, well, I'm an anthropologist. So you came back in 1947. That was a very difficult time, especially in France, I should imagine, a shattered economy and society and so on. What is your chief memory of coming back?
No. My memory of those days is glorious.
Really?
Well, I was 25, of course. This is one reason. Just got married. All the objective elements of happiness are there. But society was open for young people. Anyone had the feeling that he would have a purpose and a place in the society, something to do, that they needed you. That was very, very strong. From the very early beginning in Paris, in fact. Britain, scientifically speaking, had a very big influence on me. So I used to come very often to England, mostly England. Sometimes, a couple of times I went to Scotland. And of course, from the practical viewpoint, life was much more difficult in England than in France. Because practically, black market had become a grey market. So, yes, there were rationing, but it was not really serious.
In France?
In France. But in England, my goodness, it has been strong until the early 50s. I remember coming here, had the horrible breakfast with sausages, I don't know what they had in.
Whale meat.
But no, it was really difficult, no heating and so on. I mean, it a feeling of... But this was not depression by any means. stimulated us, rather. Yeah. So, I mean, our happy society now, easygoing and so on, is depression for young people. Mm. Very difficult to find your place, and it was not then.
Mm. What did you come back to do? Because
science.
Hmm. Were you doing? Did you do a doctorate or?
Yes, in Paris.
In Paris, on what was the subject?
Crystallography.
Crystallography. Yep. Oh, so you're beginning to move across from mechanical engineering.
Well, I say mechanical engineering because it's like a funny dress, right? Mm. But as I say, it took a very long time and not much to work to get my degree. So I had plenty of time to read what I wanted, and I tried to get to learn some physics, mathematics, and so on. So I didn't have any feeling of being misplaced in Paris. I went to the lab and I did my work. I had to learn something, yeah. Mm. But I mean, it was not worth it. You know, nowadays, education gets extremely special. You can get special courses in anything, even in anthropology, I guess. Okay. But many, many of the people who have been pioneers in those days were self-made men, very, very often. Mm. You know, many of the molecular biologists, that's particularly true in America, are chemists and physicists who worked for the atomic bomb. And they decided, as the war ended, I didn't want to go there anymore. There'd be something else. So they were not trained in the university to be molecular biologists. And that's probably the way molecular biology or biology became molecular. It was made by people who were not biologists, basically.
Mm. Very interesting. I know you don't want to talk about this much because you talked about it elsewhere a lot, but 1947, I think, to 1950 was when you were working in the same laboratory as Rosalind Franklin.
Yes.
And I picked up the bits of the story from Aaron Klug when he went down in 1954 to work and met her, and he talks about her there, and one or two other people obviously have discussed her. So if you don't mind, once again, just briefly, was she in the same laboratory as you, or?
Yes. When I went to my lab in Paris, she was already there. She had been there for a few months, I think. Mm. So we shared the lab and the facilities, and dark room, balance room, things like that. Mm. So we met every day. Mm.
And there have been many appreciations and comments on her, but since you knew her well, and I believe you went on holiday with her, and
yes.
And your famous photographs have disappeared for a while. I don't know whether they've come back yet, but we'll come back to that in a minute. But if you don't mind telling me, you know, what she was like a little bit, you know.
Well, I'm going to say a few comments, but some questions that I hate to have been asked.
Yes, too many times.
Too many times, yes. Mm-hmm. A few points that have not been asked that many times. I mean, I was just married then. I married in 47. So I would go, my wife was very busy as a medical student. So in the evening I would tell her something about the people in the lab, and I described Rosalind. And my wife had a partly British education. She was a strong reader, a person who needed to spend a lot of time reading. And she was familiar with the novels of the late 18th century, British novels of the 18th century, and they had the feeling, I mean, she just felt that Rosalind was one of those characters. Mm-hmm.
Jane Austen, you mean, that sort of
thing? That kind of thing, yeah. Mm-hmm. And she was very curious about her. Mm-hmm. And so she came to dinner with us, we met, and so on. And they were very good friends, Rosalind and my wife. And so, you know, we would go weekends, bike cycling around Paris. She would join us, and then we went to Tuscany. That was a major couple of weeks in Tuscany. Was unforgettable vacations. We had, my wife wasn't in Dara. Mm. That's what I can say. And we have been friends until the end of our life. Mm. I mean, Rosalind spent her last Christmas vacations with us.
Mm. I mean, she was obviously a very distinguished and important scientist. I mean, what the impression you get from films about her and so on is that she was extremely hardworking, very dedicated, very tenacious, very careful.
Anything she did was done that way.
Mm. Okay. Was there more? I mean, you know the definitions of science. Well. Science and other things, 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. Did she have that 1% inspiration?
Certainly more than 1%. But it's difficult to say. She was an extremely competent person, very earnest. Mm. And when she said yes is yes, no is no. Mm. I know, I don't know. Mm. Right? She didn't like cheating to herself or to anybody.
Mm.
And she had a difficult character, by all means.
Yes, because the stories of her and Maurice Wilkins are, you know, that there was a bad chemistry between them and it's thought to be on both sides, so it was difficult.
I think it's because of Randall's.
Mm.
I think the villain was Randall, that Rosalind found, she thought that she had a problem for herself. And Maurice thought that the problem was his.
Mm.
And that was the beginning of. And then the characters were very different.
Mm.
Maurice Wilkins was a secret man, quiet, slow.
Mm.
And Rosalind was quick and dedicated. And you had all the elements for a clash, as it happened.
Mm.
But I mean, even scientifically, I never had the feeling that Rosalind really understood the significance of DNA. At least, I mean, I left to America in 1953, the crucial year for DNA. So we corresponded perhaps, I don't remember. But I didn't see her regularly. Before that, she left to London again, I think in 50 or 51. And we met very often. I mean, she would come and stay with us, or my wife, me, and something. Together or not, would go to London, stay with her. And we kept, in those days, we talked a lot of mutual work, of her work. And she didn't give the feeling to be, of knowing that she was dealing with the secret of life, to put it that way.
Even after when it was published, I mean, after...
Well, that's the point. At that stage, I was in America.
Mm.
That 53 is a crucial year for DNA. And I don't know exactly, but all what I understand, she never resented to, you know, that Francis Crick became a very close friend. You know, she used to come to Cambridge and stay. Even more than that, she had been invited to join the MRC laboratory here. And that's why Aaron Kluck came. He took her place. So there was... She was a very good friend of Aaron, a very good friend of Francis Crick, and Nathan, I think she did that. At least it never reached my ears. And she was not a stupid person. I mean, had she felt that she had been stolen of anything, she would have resented and realized. She was not a naive person. Okay, but I mean, that story has been told so many times that I can very little to add to it.
But it's coming from your mouth, which makes it special. One interesting thing that Aaron told me, which was that he went to the year after and started to work with her, and when she showed him the two photographs, her famous photographs, she said to him something like, "I saw the helix spiral in one of them, but I couldn't see it in the other."
Yeah.
And he said, "The moment I saw the other one, I could see it." I mean, he's got a special kind of mind, as you know. So he saw both helixes. So my impression is that if he had gone to work with her a couple of years earlier...
Aaron?
Aaron, then things would have been very different.
Probably, yes. But what is certain is that had Francis Crick met her earlier, things would have been quite different. The real person she needed was Francis Crick to interact with. Francis Crick was a very generous person. I mean, and realizing how clever she was, a very good experimentalist and so on, he would have interacted with her. I think that the real shame was that they didn't meet. They met much too late, more than
Aaron.
And, you know, Aaron, well, he remembers better than I, but, I mean, what they did, Aaron and Rosalind, was to work out the helical, the diffraction by helices. So, I mean, the comment he's making now, they're not quite naive. What I'm saying. The point is not what happened in 55, what happened in 52.
Yes.
But I mean, these are minor parts.
Well, the person who worked for many years with Francis Crick and who I've interviewed was Sidney Brenner.
Yeah.
Do you know Sidney?
A little, not well.
I mean, people speak very highly of his intelligence and say that he's undoubtedly one of the most cleverest people they've ever met. But you didn't know him well. He was a fellow of King's.
No, I met him rather often, but not really well. Not like Aaron Klug or Francis Crick.
What about Jim Watson? Did you meet him?
Very little, yes.
So after, let's go on with the story. After 1950, what did you do? You went on in that laboratory for how long?
Now you come back to my history. When I stayed in that lab until the end of 52, then I moved to America for 1 year in Brooklyn. And then in 54, I went to Strasbourg, and in 62, to Gif-sur-Yvette, just south of Paris. That is my itinerary.
What were you working on? Crystallography?
Well, Francis Crick had a profound influence on me because we shared a desk, in fact, for 6 months in Brooklyn. And at that time, Francis was not quite Crick yet. But he has always been terribly available. I mean, whenever I wanted to talk to him, I could easily do that. But in those days, even he liked to talk to me, right, because he went through a difficult time in his life. And the fact we were both more or less of the same age and more or less in a similar situation, small salary, difficult life, and was his first experience of America, and my first American experience as well. So we had a lot in common. And in some respect, we were slightly unhappy for the same reason. So it was, and Francis, well, he's a terribly charismatic person. He was, unfortunately. And he convinced me that...
Unfortunately, did you say, or fortunately?
Well, because he's dead. That's what I'm saying.
I see, yes.
Yeah. No, I said he is, and then I said, unfortunately, he was. That was. I meant to say. Yes, and he convinced me that in our trade, the thing to do was biology. So if I moved to biological problems, it was because of Francis' influence. I'm quite aware of that. Then I returned to Europe. He stayed for quite a few months in America. Still, and I started in Strasbourg, then I moved to Paris, but all becomes very technical at that stage, right?
From the accounts of Sidney and others, Francis was a great talker. They just talked and talked and talked. And he had a notice, which I rather like, and I used to keep in my room, on their wall, which said, "Reading rots the mind."
Yeah, sure.
Have you seen that notice?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I quoted it very often.
And yet, when I quoted it to Sydney, he said, oh, well, that's true, we had the notice, but Francis was a great reader. He read a lot, and he may have had this notice. But what does he mean, then, that reading rots the mind, if he was a great reader?
Well, the point is that in order to do probably, because I never discussed that point. By the way, you know that a biography, which is going to be a very important one, of Francis Crick, has just been published.
That's it. Mm.
By Robert Olby. Mm. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you, if you are curious about Francis, mm. you should first read that book. Mm. But probably what he meant, I guess, was that it's a waste of time very often to quote somebody else's work. Mm-hmm. I mean, who was it? I think it was Max Delbruck who said, when there is a famous sentence, which I don't, I mean, it will come out. Mm-hmm. Don't confuse me with facts. That's very amusing.
Yes. Comment. It reminds me of my favorite quotable scientist is, of course, Einstein, and one of his many wonderful quotations was, if the facts disagree with my theories, I change the facts.
Never believe an experimental fact without a theoretical reason. That was one of his sentences. Mm. Well known.
This is one of Francis's.
Yeah, Francis, yeah. Mm. Yes.
Mm. Well, probably this is, there's only 3 or 4 minutes on this tape. It's probably a good time to, from your great knowledge of all these different scientists and your own experience, what makes a good scientist? I mean, it sounds as if this mixture of experiment with theoretical reasoning or curiosity, or what would you... If you had to pick 2 or 3 qualities from the great scientists you've met?
Probably is the feeling of the problem. I mean, or in other words, not to waste time. Yeah, to ask the good question, which is a mixture of everything, of culture, intelligence, common sense, and things like that.
Mm.
It's very difficult. It's more or less what I have in mind.
Mm.
People whose questions turn out to be essential.
Mm.
Turn out.
Mm. Well, this is when I talk to good scientists, very good scientists here, like Gabriel Horn, I don't know if you know him, and talked about people like Fred Sanger and so on, and asked why he's so good. They say, well, he has a nose for the important questions.
In Sanger's case, it's very typical.
Mm. He just knows where...
No, sure. It's time to do that.
Mm. Yes. Plus an enormous amount of hard work and organisation. Also a huge amount of application and hard work and so on. But and natural gifts. I mean, Aaron, for example, is very gifted as a linguist, as a mathematician, as a... many natural talents. Is that important? Or?
Of course. Yeah. Mm. I mean, if you want to be a runner, you need good legs to start. It's not enough.
Mm.
But you never saw someone with short legs being a good runner.
Right. Well, we've got to about 1960.
Yep.
And so there's been quite a long period since then. Tell me in a sort of the headlines of what you've been doing since?
Well, I essentially have been continuing my own work, but indeed everything will become very technical, I am afraid.
It's very nice to have something technical. I mean, I've interviewed a number of very distinguished scientists, and I asked them to explain, if possible, to a general audience, what is important about their work.
Well, okay. France and the Finnish civilization had a strong effect on my career. and probably not a very positive one. I think that I would have been probably much happier in this country. I always thought that my scientific roots were here in Cambridge, and in Oxford to some extent, and in London also, more than in Paris in the neighborhood.
What is the difference between the scientific cultures of?
I see. It's enormous.
Is it?
It's enormous, yes. I don't know how to explain to you. You're an anthropologist, and these kind of things much belong to your feeling, but most people do not understand it, or very often people do not understand what I'm saying. That the French culture suffered, in my opinion, from Auguste Comte. I mean, you have a chemist, a physicist, a biologist, an anthropologist, and they never meet. In this country, when you go to any college, I happen to have meals in high tables in a variety of colleges in Cambridge and Oxford also. And it's very surprising to be sitting next to a person who is a very different field. He comes, he has nothing to do with what you do. And I understand that it's the same thing with the students. Now in France, at the age of 17, 18, where they end secondary school, they get terribly special. They go to, they study mathematics and they meet mathematicians. And they study anthropology and they may meet only anthropologists. And this had a very strong influence. I mean, fields are sharply separated from each other. And that I remember, I did not quite well understand why Francis in particular wanted to live in Cambridge. He, you know, he did not belong to the aristocracy, the scientific aristocracy. I mean, I don't know exactly his social roots, but he, well, I think he lived in London and he went to a good university in London. He got a degree in physics. But the point he had, living in Cambridge, that he could meet anybody. And he had friends in very different areas and so on, and so he, they interacted and they had life he liked. And that what I missed, probably. I sunk among geneticists, but people who were narrowly geneticists. I mean, it's not, means nothing. I mean, molecular biology, you know Francis' definition. He was asked one day, I think it was again in TV, what is molecular biology? And he said, what interests molecular biology? And I think it's a very good answer. I mean, molecular biology is biology done by non-biologists, technically speaking. I mean, they are biologists as well. I mean, when you mentioned Sidney Brenner, he had been a biologist from the beginning, but Francis was. One of the arguments he gave to me when we were in Brooklyn, he said we should do biology. Because nowadays you can do excellent biology without having to learn it. I remember his argument.
Why do you think it's the difference is the result of Comte?
Didn't get your question.
Yeah, well, I think you said that it was Auguste Comte who made the French intellectual establishment divided into specialist subdisciplines.
Well, that I, at least is what I see now. But probably Comte has root also, you know, with history.
Because I mean, without trying to give a plug for my book on Cambridge, what I explain is that the collegiate system, which brings people in different disciplines together, died out all over continental Europe in the 18th and 19th century, particularly at the time of Napoleon, when universities were destroyed, the old French universities were destroyed. And it only survived in Oxford and Cambridge.
Yes.
And so it was a historical accident or set of causes which of a structural kind, which accidentally preserved Oxford and Cambridge, and a little bit, some of the spirit went to London and elsewhere. Whereas Italy, Spain, France, which had had the great universities of the late Middle Ages, they'd all disappeared. So it wasn't a particular individual, much as we may dislike him. It was a structural, historical...
Oh, I quite agree with you. I mean, it's quite useful and simple to say Auguste Comte in one word, but yeah. I don't think that he should go to hell for that.
Yeah. The other thing that I wondered whether you noticed, I've noticed among anthropologists, at least I've heard about it because I've never taught in France, that not only are the disciplines separated, so you don't meet people in other disciplines, but even within a discipline, there are often very strong factions and feuds, and so the discipline is sub-split, and you don't go to someone's seminar who is your enemy or you disagree with. Your students are told not to go and follow someone else. So you have rival groupings within, even within a small discipline.
Well,
is that the case?
I don't know about that. Of course, this can, you have unpleasant societies in all countries. I don't think that everything is very pleasant here. I don't think, for example, that biology would have become molecular as it did without Bernard. I mean, Bernard's role has been decisive in this country, and in Cambridge more particularly.
Did you know him at all?
Well, I've met him a few times. I wouldn't say that I knew him well, but I've met him, yes. Well, many people who have met him were still alive.
So what was he like? He was a pretty forceful character, wasn't he?
By all means. You know, he was a very quiet man, but he... Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, in any event, I mean, I don't think that what is important it was he was like, but it was what ideas he had in mind. I mean, it's a very clear idea that most of science, most of physical sciences, natural sciences, I should say, is structure. That what came out of his mind, his very strong influence. And it has been decided. I don't think that biology would be as molecular as it is today without Bernard. Because things are not that logical. I mean, some people, especially students in universities, learn biology as if it's a straight way going from one place and leading to another, starting from one place and going to another. It's not like that. At one time, someone decided that it should go in that direction. Someone was followed, sometimes not. But in this case, that good biology was physical structure was not trivial, not at all. And this was Bernard. His influence had been terrific. And what's peculiar about him, and I think because of his political positions, that he's got a Nobel Prize, for example, and I think even the establishment in this country had mixed feelings. I understand.
Yeah, I think so.
And his lab, especially his last lab in London, what college, I don't remember, was Roslin. Well, he had different departments, and the people who worked with him in those days were not particularly distinguished. I mean, his very distinguished co-worker was Dorothy Hodgkin, of course.
Was?
Dorothy Hodgkin.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yes. Was
did you know her?
Yeah.
What was she?
Fairly well.
Was she?
I spent 1 week, I think, in her house.
In Oxford, or was it?
In Oxford, but there is one of the best biographies about scientists, about Dorothy Hodgkin. Her name, Jean, I don't remember. It's a lady from Cambridge, I think. She's a writer.
I read the autobiography of Alan Hodgkin, which was interesting. He worked with Huxley.
I knew him.
I interviewed Huxley as well.
So. Yes. I watched that one. Mm. Because that's very amusing. Everyone talks about molecular biology, even in the newspapers.
Mm.
And rightly so, because the consequences of molecular biology are tremendous, I mean, in medicine, in many, many things. But in fact, from the intellectual viewpoint, I think that the real breakthrough, which took place not in Cambridge also, is electrophysiological mechanism done by Hodgkins and Hartley. Mm-hmm. About the same time, I think, 51, 52.
Yes, it was.
Is a remarkable piece of work,
mm-hmm.
far-reaching, extremely, is a profound piece of work. It's something like Darwin, if you want. It really, to have the courage of building a theory. Molecular biology is a chemical approach. Tell me about Sanger.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of approach,
right?
You express biology in chemical way, but it's not a very subtle language.
Mm-hmm.
And it became a technique, as it was,
right?
Mm. But this kind of thing would be off the record.
Mm. Well, we'll decide which bits you don't want. We'll send you a copy. Because that all sounds quite, well, very interesting and also not very contentious, but maybe it is.
No, well.
We'll see. But you started by saying that France, in some ways you wish you'd spent your intellectual life in England rather than France, but the question behind that was, what if you had to sum up for your grandchildren, shall we say, what has been the importance of your work in ordinary language? What is the question you have been asking, questions you've been asking?
Well, I have been lucky. My father always said that. I never got paid for searching, but for finding.
Mm.
And you get a salary for searching, and he was profoundly correct.
Mm.
So, I had fun throughout my life, right? I would go to the lab and amuse myself, basically, much more than anybody else, than ordinary people. So that's the point. Intellectually speaking, it has been terribly rewarding.
Mm.
I mean, to get in touch, not with famous people, but with bright people, people you learn from, people you discuss with. Francis is a typical one, but Aaron Krug was a very good friend of mine in the past, Robert and Frank, you know. I have a very good friend who is quite younger than I. He was born in 1938, and he's of the, comes from a Catalan anarchist family. His father fought in the war and so on. And he became a very good friend and a colleague of Aaron's. And one of the things that Aaron liked very much in this person is his peculiar root. I mean, the anarchist root. And it's something that is not very common in no country, but I would say in England. Usually the feeling I had that my roots, they seem to interest you, but usually people did not care much, right? They would not ask questions, but Aaron always does.
Mm.
So that's something peculiar about Aaron.
Mm.
And I'm very fond of
him. You mentioned anarchism there, and you mentioned earlier on your father's passionate denunciation of fascism and so on. What is your political opinions and life? Have you been actively engaged in politics at all in your life?
Not really. I mean, during the war, I hoped I could go and fight. I mean, it was clearly my war, right? But it turned out that it would have been possible probably in La Légion étrangère or places like that, which are a big odd. And we have been some attempts to have an Italian army on the good side. Well, it didn't work, but this was one kind of commitment I had. But it was not a very strong commitment, as a matter of fact. I mean, I never went anywhere and fought anyone. Then after the war, I never was a communist.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't smell good. I mean, the experience with fascism gave me the feeling that elections with 98% are not elections and so on. So I never trusted. And I avoided one of the pitfalls of most of people of my age who were politically committed. In France, most of them were communists at one time or another. Now, on top of that, I became a Frenchman only in 68. And before being a Frenchman, it's not good to have a political activity in France of any kind. And I have been of the mild left, which may be Parti Socialiste, I mean, it doesn't mean much, and not a real commitment.
68 was a good time to become a Frenchman.
The time, no, why not?
The time of the Troubles and
well, the Troubles were very strong, but didn't last very long. It had been worse in other countries, like Italy, that lasted for years and years. In France, it lasted a few weeks. I was not very sympathetic with those kind of things. Never.
Well, we've covered many things, but I'm always aware that there's probably something important, many important things, but one or two things that you'd like to have said that I didn't ask you about. Is there anything that I should have asked you that would have been important to understand your life and work? I haven't asked
you
about...
Probably, let's say that circumstances played an immense role. But this to most of us, not the British. In this respect, you, the British, do not seem to have a very strong dramatic feeling of history. Well, it's enough to look around. There is a kind of continuity going on. Well, this is not in my case. I mean, and you were talking about Alan Clark. I mean, if you look at his folks, I mean, the family where he lived, the chances to survive the war were 1 in 100,000 or something like that. Most of the people, of the Jewish people from Lithuania, were swept away completely. So, I mean, and this is something, je suis un rescapé, a survivor, right? And this is a feeling I have, quite a strong one. So many of the things are I didn't gain much, I didn't earn. It's not my merit. It's chance more than anything else. Let's put it that way. Okay? What I did is because I had the chance to be allowed to do it. Right?
Yes. Well, a lot of the people I've interviewed, not on the sort of national scale of disasters and atrocities, but on small scale, many of the good scientists, particularly biologists, people like Michael Bate and so on, kept saying, and then there was the fortunate chance, then I was lucky to meet so-and-so, then I was lucky to go to America. It was all chances.
It's clear. I mean, I had the chance to go to Argentina. Well, it was a logical chance because of the story of my grandpa. All right, so happened. And then after the war, I had the chance to go to France. I could have gone to America. By the way, I had applied for a scholarship and I got it, but too late. So I didn't go to America. Now, what would have happened to me in America? Who knows? No, I went to France at the right time. They needed young people, I would say. It's an open society. Immediately after the war. And I had quite a good career. I do not complain. I had all the chances, the opportunities, and so on. So, and I did not belong to any family. I mean, I was not doomed to. Never.
Never trapped.
No, but trapped is a, I would say doomed to. I mean, Darwin was not my great grandfather, like some of the people that you
yes,
know.
Right. Right.
Yes.
Just the last question, which is, if you were advising a young PhD student scientist, actually, I haven't asked you about whether you have done much teaching. Do you have to do teaching?
No, this is one of the regrets of my life. Because, you know, in France, you had to be Frenchman to be a teacher. In those days. Mm. Not anymore. Mm. Right. So, without being a Frenchman, I could not become a university teacher.
Good heavens.
Mm. It was like that. Mm. But it changed in 69 or 70. Mm. Mm. And then it was a bit too late. Mm. I tried, but the condition was not good. I had no reason to do that. And I regret that.
Because one of the strengths of the system here, I think, is, as many people have said, is that certainly at one stage in your life you have to lecture, you have to do undergraduate supervision teaching and so on. And many people find this stressful and tiring, but very stimulating too, having good students.
I think that Aaron, for example, liked it.
Yes, he did.
And I know that Francis Crick hated it, and he never did. Mm. He was not a member of any college. Mm. He avoided it. Mm. So it depends on the people.
So the last question was, if you were advising a PhD student or a young scientist starting out, is there, what advice would you give them?
To have a clear idea of what he wants to do and do it. Mm. Do not worry about the future, whether he should learn Chinese or Italian. Or if you like Chinese, go on. Mm. But try to like something. Because you're not given many choices. Mm. This would be my strong opinion about that.
Good. Well, thank you very much indeed, Vittorio. That's very kind of you.